Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Hidden Brain, hosted by Shankar Vedantam. Hidden Brain uses science and storytelling to help you understand the world around you and yourself. Wondering why it's so hard to change your best friend's political views? Feeling like you're in a bit of a rut and need to get unstuck? Hidden Brain can help you with those questions and plenty of others. Find it now on the NPR One app or at npr.org/podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll get pretty ugly with the new Disney live-action version of Beauty and the Beast, and we'll tell you what we learned at this year's South by Southwest Festival. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair is our faithful South by Southwest correspondent, Katie Presley. Katie,
hey.
When you are not here at Pop Culture Happy Hour, what do you do?
I'm the music editor for Bitch Media.
Well, it's always good to have Katie. And before we get started with her, we do want to note, by the way, that tickets are still available for our Chicago live show on April 12th. Sam Sanders will be in our fourth chair, our special guest, as we announced this week. W. Kamau Bell.
Ooh.
Pretty exciting. So get those tickets at nprpresents.org. So before we talk about South by Southwest, we are going to talk about Beauty and the Beast. The 1991 animated Disney musical Beauty and the Beast was nominated for Best Picture, and it won Oscars for its score and for the title song. Now, more than 25 years later, Disney has produced a live-action version of the musical. Emma Watson plays Belle, our bookish young heroine who's imprisoned by the Beast, played with a lot of digital modifications by Dan Stevens. But over time, they fall in love and learn the highly romantic lesson that you should embrace the ugly person of your dreams because he might be hot on the inside. It also stars Luke Evans, Josh Gad, Kevin Kline, Emma Thompson, and many, many others. It set a record in its opening weekend for the highest earning March opening weekend of all time. I feel like it was most famous for the dancing candlestick and clock and all those and the little teapot. This time around, those are all CGI weird, semi-real.
Steven, CGI steampunk.
Yeah. Steven, you're making a little bit of a face. How did you feel about the animated object part of all of this?
Watching it, I found myself really admiring in hindsight what an incredible medium animation is.
Yeah.
Because animation allows you to tell this fairly simple story in this very breezy way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you take a musical number like Be Our Guest.
They can sing, they can dance. After all, miss, this is France. And a dinner here is never second best.
And it's very Busby Berkeley.
It's very,
the little circle dances.
Yeah, tons of that stuff. But it also is very light on its feet.
Yeah.
What this movie is not is light on its feet.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is 45 minutes longer.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking a set piece like that from animation into steampunk CGI, everything you see in your imagination now has to be made sort of realistic.
Right.
Everything feels bigger and louder and clunkier,
yeah.
Like you can feel it clanking as it goes.
Yeah.
And so for me, I love the source material so much, and it's working with the same source material. It's very devoted to the source material in many ways. So it has all these components that I naturally enjoy and I'm naturally drawn to, but it's leaden by comparison.
Yeah, and one of the things that I had sort of forgotten until we were trying to figure out how to talk about this is that there was also a Broadway musical
right. Based
on that animated movie. So it's not the first effort to take that animated movie and make it into visible human beings singing and dancing. But it's interesting to me because on stage, you just have to give in and the candlestick is just a guy in a candlestick suit, I assume. And in this, we keep saying CGI. I don't know if that's exactly the term,
right.
But it's digital. It's a digitally created dancing candlestick voiced by Ewan McGregor. Katie, what did you think of the movie?
Linda, you were saying the original was famous for the songs and the dancing teacups. I think it was famous for the rampant eroticism of the Beast.
Nice.
So if that's what you mean by stronger relationship, Glenn, yes. I had a very strong relationship.
All right. I want to hear about the rampant eroticism of the Beast.
Unrelatedly, reading this gender theory book, as one does in one's free time, called The Male Body by Susan Bordeaux, and it came out in 1998. And I stumbled upon a part about Beauty and the Beast, which I didn't know. So I'll read you these couple of sentences and you tell me if you knew these facts. It says, the Disney people recognized the erotic charge of their Beast. They delayed making the film for a decade, worried about the sexual overtones of the story. Mm-hmm. Until they finally hit on the solution of having constant chaperones around in the castle in the form of all those talking teapots and dinnerware. But it was the makers of the film, of course, who endowed the Beast with all that. Thank you, Glenn. Who endowed the Beast with all that sex appeal to begin with. So I had no idea about any of that, that that was the kind of origin story of the talking, singing Mrs. Potts. Mm-hmm. But boy, howdy, was I aware of the erotic potential of the Beast. So actually, watching this movie, the main thing I was thinking of was, like, are they making Belle a feminist because it's a totally feminist character? And this is one thing that 2017 might get better than 1991. And is the Beast sufficiently hot?
Mm-hmm. What was your verdict?
Not.
I have so many questions.
I'm slamming the book shut. Full
okay.
Attention.
So you say Belle is a feminist character, mm-hmm. should or could be a feminist character.
Should or could.
Here's my question. This entire story is about, you know, you are kidnapped, you are taken by force, and eventually you fall in love with your captor. To me, that is the gender politics of that are so bad just as a concept that I question how on earth it would be or could be rescued mm-hmm. from that aspect. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I think that there were several additions to the plot here that were really strange to me, mm-hmm. but they did give Belle more opportunities to be an agent, right? So she, like, her dad picks the lock when they are locked up together.
Right.
Not a thing that happens.
Right.
She takes off. Mm-hmm. So he, like, chit-chats with the guard about, like, women, sheesh. And she jets
right.
off to the
yep.
palace. So she, like, ran around a little more
right.
in this one. And I also think maybe this is just because of, like, bless her heart forever, Emma Watson's kind of awkwardness.
Yeah.
The love story didn't, like, as it were, sing to me. I did not look at them and think, wow, sparks are a-flying, like yeah. I guess I did between the cartoon Beast.
Well, let me try to bring a couple of those things we've been talking about together. We talked about the CGI. We talked about the lack of chemistry between them. I think they are related because the eyes of Dan Stevens as the Beast are so dead. He
totally.
Looks like a dead-eyed yak. And that is not necessarily a sexy Beast.
You just lost five listeners.
And when he becomes the prince again, spoiler, he looks like a fop in a handsome wig, you know? It's
and
just,
then,
it's
and
not.
They zoom in on his eyes like she's having this big recognition, like, oh, the Beast is still in there. And I was like, no, now you're looking at a human. And
yeah.
before...
And not to get too far off track, I felt like this movie fixed a little bit of the problem with the 1991 version, where you watch the 1991 version, the Beast gets turned into a guy, and you're like, who's this schmo? And this movie at least has a throwaway line that is a little bit of a sop to, like, could you do something so you're a little more hot like how you were?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, could you grow a beard?
There is something about the way they present him that is not... magnetic, that is weird and sort of over-determined. Does that make sense?
Right.
Sure.
Well, the performance I liked a lot because this Beast, the way Stevens is portraying him, underneath all that computer gym crackery, he's snippier.
Yeah.
He's funnier. Mm-hmm. He's a funnier Beast. And he's also sort of waspish, I guess I would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He also at one point does a certain amount of, like, at one point he beast-splains Shakespeare to her.
Yeah, a little bit.
And,
yeah.
And she's supposed to fall in love with that? I don't think so.
Well, I don't think, I didn't take that as beast-splaining. I saw that same thing go by on Twitter. I just took it as him being like Romeo and Juliet, blech, which is a different thing. That's not explaining anything. He just has an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it's like, well, actually.
You know what that's actually about is.
Right. Yeah. But I agree with you that there's something that's missing from the love story between them.
Mm-hmm.
The parts of it that I liked the best were the parts that weren't really relying on that. Like, I kind of enjoyed the Belle opening where she's kind of going through the town mm-hmm. and all that I thought was appealing. And I liked the Emma Thompson as Mrs. Potts. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very sweet. We love us some Emma Thompson.
Sure. Did you find that Emma Watson's performance as Belle, especially in that opening number, was different than the, obviously it was different than the cartoon, but it struck a different note for me.
Yes.
Because, of course, we need that song in this thing. It's the right. I Wish song. Every musical needs it. In the animated film, Belle is just filled with wonder and hope, yes. and she's yearning. And Emma Watson gives it a kind of irony.
Little town, full of little people.
Animated Belle was like quixotic, almost. Mm-hmm. The point is people think she's silly because her head is always in a book or in the clouds. This spell was like, ugh, I'll just keep picking my kale over here,
right.
feeding these damn chickens.
In this crap hole of a town.
Exactly.
In this farm, which is somehow on a main street.
Right, exactly. Just pop off Main Street into my garden.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and I did appreciate the fact that I think in the category of things that I think they tried to bring a little more roundness to, I think they did try to make her father a little bit less absurd. Mm-hmm. They tried to make her father a little more of a grieving person and right. a little bit less of a wacky person.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Luke Evans as Gaston was fine, although Agreed. That's the one that I think it's really tough to get across without the literally cartoonish
yeah.
body that right. that is on that guy. It's such a visual joke that he's this gigantic, you know, if it had been The Rock. Like, yeah. I feel like it should
exactly.
have been The Rock. Why isn't it The Rock? Why didn't
dear
The Rock,
Disney.
Like, dear Disney, should have
well,
been The
when
Rock.
He says, I'm roughly the size of a barge,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
you picture the animation in right. your head. It's so funny.
And they also, they cut back the lyrics a little bit. So there are a couple of pieces of lyrics, including no one plots like Gaston, takes cheap shots like Gaston, plans to persecute harmless crackpots like Gaston,
yeah. right.
which is the kind of lyric in that film that I think is so delightful.
Right.
And they prune back quite a bit of that.
Yeah, and I felt like maybe it was the mix in the theater where Katie and I watched the movie, but I found a lot of the lyrics really hard to understand. The more cluttered these production numbers were, the harder they were to hear.
Particularly in that song,
yeah.
which really
yeah.
relies heavily on the ability for mostly Josh Gad to be able to deliver those endings of rhymes are what makes that song so funny,
right.
is to get those rhymed endings of those silly lines. And he's a theater guy.
Right.
You know he can do it. I felt like the sound mix was not good, particularly on that song. It really bothered me.
And also, did you all have to see it in 3D?
No.
No. Nope.
Good. If you did, at least in our theater, when I saw it with Jessica, it was really murky, really, really dark, especially
yeah.
the castle. The castle is supposed to be dark.
It is a dark movie, so I can see how if you had the additional 3D
yeah.
sort of haze, that wouldn't be good.
Let's talk Josh Gad. Let's not talk a long time about Josh
yeah.
Gad, because we shouldn't spend a lot of time on it, but
no.
Glufu is the first gay character in a Disney musical. No, he's not. And if you think he is, I have two words for you. Sensational news. That's it. It was so overhyped, this
yes,
nothing of a thing. And
nothing.
It's all it is, it's the same gay joke that Hollywood's been making forever, but without the fear behind it, without the gay panic.
Right.
So that feels like progress, but this little exchange he has at the end of the film is nothing. And
nothing.
It's no hill to die on. It's nothing
right.
to get excited about. It's nothing to get upset about. It's so nothing.
You won't notice it if you're not looking for it, I would argue. And also, it comes packaged with a conflating of homosexuality and cross-dressing,
yeah,
which
sure.
I feel
right.
like is in this movie where they're like, look how far ahead we are. We're all the way up here in 1985. Like,
I mean, this is a film directed by Bill Condon. It's got Ian McKellen, and it's just got, it feels different when the jokes are coming from inside the house,
yeah.
but they're the same jokes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also didn't care much for the songs that were added. They
right.
did
oh,
add some is. Songs. There is a big a beast a number.
Oh, my God.
Yes, we got it. We got it queued up. That is the Les Misiest song
oh,
I have
my
ever
God.
Heard.
Yeah.
And I'm going to play you right now the Les Misiest part of this Les Misy song.
Wasting in my lonely tower, waiting by an earth.
I'll fool myself, she'll walk right in. And as the long, long nights begin, I'll think of all that might have been waiting here for.
Come on.
That is Les Mis. That is very Les Mis.
I could feel Katie's eyes roll just next to me.
I just don't think it has the charm of the music from the original animated film. And the funny thing is, there's a bunch of music that they wrote for the Broadway show, and they didn't use that either.
Oh, wow.
This is different new music. So
well, because they want an Oscar. They want a Best Original Song.
We're getting
Oscar.
To kind of a copy of a copy. I don't know.
It's just funny. Like, every time I enjoyed it, it was because it reminded me of the movie from 1991.
Right.
And anything that they tried to add to it just didn't work for
me. Yeah. I saw this with producer Jessica Reedy, and I don't want to speak for her, but basically what she said is something very similar to what Katie said, not about the sexuality of the beast, but she... This
Come
was
on,
one,
Jess.
This was... This was, at least she didn't say that to me, this was one of the first films she ever saw, and she had no idea how much it was inscribed upon her body. Every scene, and there's lots of shot-for-shot remix in this thing. It didn't land with me. I saw this film once when I was, I think, in college or whatever. Andrew Lappin reviewed it for the NPR website. What he said was, its chief directive is not to conjure wonder, but nostalgia. And I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I definitely hope it doesn't supplant the 1991 film. You know, I hope kids watch both.
Yeah. We can love more than one thing. And speaking of loving more than one thing, when we come back, we are going to talk about the South by Southwest Festival, where we all got to love many, many things. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ZipRecruiter. When you own a business, if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. Thanks to ZipRecruiter, you can post to 200 plus job sites with one single click and have the highest chance of finding that perfect candidate. Plus, you can instantly be matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Businesses of all sizes have used ZipRecruiter. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/happy hour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. This is the time of year when we often descend upon Austin, Texas to enjoy different parts of the South by Southwest Festival. It has an interactive part that's about tech and a film festival and a music festival. And we've got reports on some of the goings-on from all of those corners. So we are going to talk about that. First up, we're going to go directly to what is often the meat of this segment, and that is some talk about music. Stephen and Katie are going to share some picks. I'm going to alternate between you guys. Stephen, give me your first one.
All right, well, this is just a big meatball pitch down the middle of just an absolutely irresistible song by a guy from Flint, Michigan named Tunde Olanaran. His live show has kind of a performance art quality to it. He has dancers who are enshrouded in these garments and everything. But then the songs spring to life and just explode with ideas. This song is called Namesake.
Now maybe there's a lesson I've been given, or some wisdom from the stories that I need to tell. And everybody's hoping and scraping and wishing they could be something outside themselves. If I can be me, then you can be yourself. Might not be easy. It's like we're never satisfied.
So you just hear that kind of like, it just goes womp, 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 womp. And like all of a sudden, all these ideas are just out front. He's so fun, such a joy-filled, but in many ways, very serious performer. I loved his set. I love his record. Katie actually got me into Tunde Olanaran.
You're welcome.
So she gets a point.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. I want to go to Katie for your first pick. Katie, I have to say, your first pick, even I have heard of.
Wow.
I know, right?
My first song is by Lizzo. Lizzo was born and raised in Houston, is now in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is where she founded several all-lady hip-hop crews, and now she's doing her own thing. And wow, is she doing her own thing. So I heard from a publicist that she's been coming to South by for 4 years. This is so obviously her year. The hustle has paid off. This is a person who knows exactly what she wants to look like, exactly what she wants to sound like. Her dancers are flawless creations of humanity. They are called the Big Girls. And I saw her twice. She apparently played 8 times. I take each of those 6 other times as a personal insult that I was not in the room. Lizzo, I'm so sorry. This song is called Worship. Baby, worship me. Worship me. All you need.
Patiently, quietly, faithfully. Worship me.
Lizzo is the face of feminism that I want to see. She's doing everything right, and she's unapologetic, and she's brash and loud and fun. Man, if this is the direction we're going in the world, I am so happy. I cannot say enough good things about Lizzo. Lizzo, can I be part of your crew?
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Katie Pressley. Stephen Thompson, give me another pick from you.
So late one night, I strolled into a club to see...
Da-na-na-na-na.
to see a group from Brazil called Lineker e Os Caramelos. And I had gotten into their music via Alt Latino here at NPR and had, you know, read about and then heard this very dramatic and sad kind of almost tragic sounding ballads. I put one on the Austin 100 called Remonta, and it's beautiful, but I expected to walk into this kind of grieving process in song, and instead walked into a party. So the singer, Lineker Barros, a lot of the songs on her record are a little slower, but by the end of the set, and I happened to catch the end of the set, she's just smiling and strutting, and the whole room just kind of had this throb and this just this joyful kind of pulsing quality to it that I just loved. So the song I want to hear is called Lina X. A personalidade dela era tanto dividida. Parece Poliana, querendo quê de vida. Queria parte, outra da metade. O todo, tudo, a casualidade. Yeah, so that's Lineker e Os Caramelos, you know, which they can do the hell out of a ballad, but boy, when they want to strike up the band, it is a party.
Thank you very much, buddy. I like that pick. Katie Pressley, hit me.
So my next pick is like a party, but instead of fun, it's rage. So my second pick is by Moor Mother. That's M-O-O-R space Mother. This is a Philadelphia artist and poet, and this was her first South By, and her work is not for the faint of heart. It's not for the faint of ear. To me, it is just a bundle of righteous anger and a riotous spirit. So this is Moor Mother. This song is called By the Light. Mama, speaking, get your hands off me. And get these chains off me. Get off me. Came in the world out the pussy. Mama pushing. 5 seconds on the earth. Block 50. From all the action. He's dealing with the slash. Wanna be the master. Benefactor. Evil, evil. Back off the planet. Sing along.
I know you know it. Come in on the chorus.
Oh, yes. Thank
Follow
you for the
bouncing spleen. Yes.
The gift of being able to play that for you and watch your faces is my Christmas present this year, so thank you. By the Light by Moor Mother. The record is called Fetish Bones, and I think there's a zine by the same name. She's a zinester. I'm really compelled by what she's doing, and if you have the chance to see her live, it's even more than what it just was in your ears.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Katie Pressley, for telling me that there are still zines.
Yep.
I appreciate that. Stephen Thompson, third and final pick.
Well, what I have is perfect for coming out of Moor Mother, because it's very, very similar.
Is it a marching band?
It's one of many delightful electropop artists that I heard while down there. It's very easy
given the preponderance of laptops in music, to say like, oh, I went to this show and it was just a guy standing at a laptop hitting a space bar.
Right.
And I saw this year, I felt like I saw more and more musicians who managed to incorporate laptops into their set without just doing that. Whether it was Sylvan Esso dancing in this wonderfully evocative, just like very visually striking way, or this band from Mexico called De Osos that I really liked, where they had like a band performing behind a laptop. And like the laptop was just a component instead of just here I'm playing my record.
Right.
The song I'm going to play is by a duo called Overcoats. Which are so charming and delightful. We just recorded a Tiny Desk concert with them that is so great. I in part made this pick because I just think people will love this song. It's called Hold Me Close. There's actually a remix with More Mother. No, there isn't.
Oh my God. My hands just got sweaty in that split second. Oh, wow.
But they,
do that to me.
Those beautiful harmonies.
It's very Lily and Madeline.
It's Lily and Madeline-esque. It's also even like a softer Sylvan Esso. Any number of bands that are using electronics in warm ways and figuring out how to use electronics in warmer and warmer and warmer ways. So that's Overcoats. I find them delightful.
I feel like it's what the Roaches would sound like now if they were electropop. All right, Katie Presley, third and final.
My last pick is by Samus, who's a, I'm not even going to get all her hyphens. She's a rapper and writer and gamer and PhD student. So if you're a gamer, that name might sound familiar. Samus Aran is the main character of the Metroid series. And I didn't know this. Samus, the rapper, tells this story in her show. Oh. So several hours into gameplay, it is revealed that Samus, after slaying all the Glenn, tell me if you slay things in this game. After theoretically slaying all the things, it is revealed that Samus is a woman. And Samus, the rapper, said that changed her entire life. It's like, what? Everybody now thinks this character kicks butt. And like, psych, you liked a girl.
Yeah. So. And there were actually several games in the series before that revelation came out.
Several games in which Samus, the character,
you just don't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Nice.
So in her raps, Samus, who spells her name with two M's to make the difference, she is both vulnerable and very proud and very fierce. So I would use words like self-love and self-actualization to highlight what I love about Lizzo. And Samus, the difference is Samus is coming from a darker place. So I picked a song called 1080p.
In a few months since the last verse, since I called you bad words, I went ahead and got my master's. I trimmed the last of my relaxers, so my fro big, got some more gigs. My cell phone says I'm roaming, cause I'm on tour. I want more, forget home, so I go big. I was taking pills up in the bathroom. Ended up alone in grad school. I'm Mario, I busted ass, but my prize is
I'm so in awe. She's like my age. I think she is exactly my age. I'm 30. And she's getting her PhD in science and tech studies at Cornell. Okay. Cool. I washed a dish yesterday.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Katie Presley. I very much enjoyed that. So the music is the meat of our South by Southwest segment, but we do also want to touch on what Glenn and I did while we were down there. We were down there much shorter time than Katie and Stephen. Glenn, I think you did mostly film festival stuff. What did you see while you were down there?
When you are overwhelmed, if you're not a crowd person, you go to find films because that is quiet and sitting. Two things that are at a premium at South by Southwest. So the first one was a documentary called David Lynch, The Art Life, which is about David Lynch's early childhood and his first love, which is painting. And the guy is such a purely visual artist, and these paintings are, I will shock you, disturbing and creepy, that that there's a disconnect in this film. It's not entirely successful because his affect is so, gee whiz, oh golly, that's neat. And so he's not the best narrator of his life experience, which of course is kind of meta, right? Because, you know, Blue Velvet, for example, is about the white picket fences, everything looking fine, and then this dark stuff underneath it. He tells us one story about being a young kid and seeing a naked woman walking down the street, kind of dazed, which of course recurs, happens in Blue Velvet. And what he tells us about that is, boy, that was something. It's like, well,
wow.
Yeah. The other film was another documentary called Rat Film, which examines the history of Baltimore with respect to its ongoing efforts at exterminating rats. Mm-hmm. And it also brings in all kinds of stuff about racial segregation and the history of racial segregation in Baltimore. There are really goofy parts. There are really moving parts. They find this one great exterminator who you just got to point a camera at this guy and you got a film. And it doesn't tell a story. It's very fragmented. It's sort of expressionistic, impressionistic, whatever you want to call it. We get facets of this thing. But it was really fascinating. That's a rat film.
Yeah. It's funny because Bob Mondello saw a documentary at the Toronto Film Festival that was about rats. That one was a Morgan Spurlock film. And I refused to go because I knew it would only upset me. So that's what you saw. You saw a couple movies. Mm-hmm. You were on a panel.
Yep.
And I was also on a panel. I was on a panel with Kevin Smokler, who wrote a book called Brat Pack America. Mm-hmm. And it's about the sense of place in 80s teen movies. So we talked about that in a panel that I was on. That was a lot of fun. Kevin was lovely. People there were so nice. I met several fans of the show. Thanks to you guys for coming out. And the thing that Glenn and I both went to was our good pal Guy Branum did a live version of Talk Show the Game Show, which is a live format he's been doing for a while, which is about to turn into a show on True TV. And I was his emergency backup guest because what it is it's gamifying being on a talk show. So the guests on the talk show get scored by the very, I'm going to say, brutal scorekeeper for how they do at being a talk show guest. You get points for name dropping and points for an anecdote, points if the audience laughs. And you can also get yellow carded or red carded. And I was the emergency guest in the audience for if someone got in the penalty box. So I had to go up and finish their segment, and I got a bunch of, I got points, and it was ding, ding, the bell is going off, and it's all very stressful. And then one of the guests actually got thrown off the show and banned for life. So then I had to finish the whole rest of the thing. I got to meet Scott Thompson from
Points for Name Dropping.
And I got to meet Nick Thune of comedy and acting. And I got to be judged by Wanda Sykes, who was one of the judges. And it was really fun.
It is such a smart idea for a show.
It is
so well thought out and well executed and very, very funny.
And Guy is the host. And Joel Kim Booster, also of comedy, was the scorekeeper. It was a really fun night. So that is what we did at South by Southwest. If you have questions about that or you want to tell us what you like to do at South by Southwest or ask more questions about music, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you like to do when you are down in Austin. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Match, where you can find the meaningful connection you are looking for. Match is number one in first dates and also in second dates. Plus, finding your someone is easier when you download their mobile app. Get your matches sent directly to your phone. For Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners, go to match.com/pop to get 7 days completely free to search and connect on Match today.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, hit me.
So little did we know when we did a live show in Los Angeles with the comedian and actor Kumail Nanjiani, little did we know when we were talking about rom-coms that he had made one of the best rom-coms I've ever seen.
Oh, sneaky.
It's called The Big Sick, and it's about his real-life courtship with his wife, Emily V. Gordon, with whom he co-wrote the movie and who is also wonderful and charming in real life, and basically it's the story of how they meet. They fall in love. They have a falling out because he didn't tell his parents he was dating her because they wanted him to get an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. And then she gets very, very sick, and he winds up in effect bonding with her parents, who are played by the wonderful Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, who are so funny and so weird and so moving in this film. It is absolutely equal parts very, very funny and very, very romantic. And if you like a romantic comedy, if you miss the steady outpouring of like mainstream Hollywood romantic comedies that are moving and funny and have like movie stars in them, this is just right in your sweet spot. I know I sat there this entire movie just feeling smug that I was seeing it before Linda. Because Linda Holmes, you will love this movie so, so, so much. Everyone in it is funny.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson, for gloating in my face. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A documentary called The Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened has just now begun streaming on Netflix. It is the story of the original Broadway production of Merrily We Roll Along from 1981. Merrily We Roll Along is a Stephen Sondheim musical, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, directed by Hal Prince, book by George Firth. It tells the story of three friends. We meet them in late middle age as they're embittered and they've lost all their dreams. And we go back in time over the course of the musical until we end with them as three hopeful young people filled with dreams. It was a famous flop, ended in 16 performances. And the story of Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened begins with one of the actors from that show in the modern day finding a box filled with footage of a film that people were taking as that show was ramping up originally. So you see the disconnect between where he is now and what he looked like back then. And we meet several people over the course of it. And for the first hour of this documentary, it reminds you a lot of the Company documentary, the documentary about the making of Company.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not as good, but it's perfectly fine and solid. And you get about an hour in and you're like, well, that's the end of the little story about this musical. So what's next? And what's next is a half an hour where we catch up with a lot of the people from that show whose lives have gone in many different directions. One of them is Jason Alexander. He did okay for himself.
Yeah.
But this last half hour, which you do not see coming, is just fascinating and gutting, and it takes this little story to a whole other level, because of course what's happening is they are now middle-aged, and the film you've just seen is about them being very young and full of hope, and this musical is going to go and run forever. It is exactly the opposite of the arc that the musical takes. It is so well put together and such a surprise, and you should just run and watch this thing now. It's called Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened on Netflix.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Katie Presley, what is making you happy this week?
I have two things. The first is South By related. So every year at South By Southwest, I take photos of every band that I see so that I remember who I saw. And I take a picture in the venue, not of the band.
Yes.
So I have to sometimes get pretty creative. I mean, I think I'm kind of a genius. taking pictures of things, especially the thing about South By, you're going to see 20 bands in the same place. So it's really hard, guys. I have to find 20 new things in the venue to take a picture of. Anyway, I did it. I took a picture of every quote-unquote band that I saw. I took a picture of many, 20 things, you know, a million things for every band that I saw. And my friend Andrew Storyfied it.
Aww.
So I found out what Storyfy was. Seems super helpful.
Aww, so, it is.
Yeah, we will link to the tweet where he says he has Storyfied it.
That's
His
right.
explanation is, I Storyfied it so that the Pulitzer Committee can find it all in one place.
That's right. And we'll link to that if you come to npr.org/PCHH and you come and find us. We'll have a blog post there.
My other thing is a 2014 book called The Storied Life of A.J. Fikri. I read it in Austin, and I am telling you, you get back at 3:00 in the morning every night from these shows, and I regularly stayed up an extra 45 minutes so that I could read this thing, and I didn't take it outside the hotel room because I didn't want to drop it in the dirties out on the street. And this book, I love it. It's about a small bookstore, an independent bookstore owner named A.J. Fikri. He's very prickly. He doesn't have very many friends. His wife has recently been killed. And his rep, his publisher rep for Nightly Press has recently changed. So all these changes, none of them welcome. And it ends up being the most optimistic, funny, hopeful book. If you've read the Thursday Next series, it's the same sort of like, this is a book for people who love books and love inside, love to be nudged by the author, who, by the way, is Gabrielle Zevin, love to be nudged by the author about other books that everybody loves. Let's talk about all the books that we love. So The Storied Life of A.J. Fikri It is a book for book people.
Wonderful. And who is the author again?
The author is Gabrielle Zevin.
Thank you very much, Katie Presley. I have been reading a book, and it is a book, a nonfiction book about baseball. It's called The Arm, Inside the $1 Billion Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. It's by Jeff, I'm going to say Passan. It might be Passan. This is what I get for reading people as writers who I don't hear talk, but it's Passan. It is a book about Tommy John surgery, which is the elbow surgery done on pitchers that's essentially to fix when your arm comes apart. When sort of the pressure causes basically the two bones in your arm to come apart. And there's a whole thing in there, obviously, about the business of baseball and the stress on pitchers. But they also bring it down to how, like, very often Tommy John surgery, which was pioneered in the mid-70s, basically, is now being often performed on high schoolers because they pitch. If you're a good pitcher, even in high school, you pitch so much. And it gets into how, like, kids' sports has gone from being something where, like, if you're a great athlete, you might play football in the fall and you might play basketball in the winter and you might play baseball in the spring. Now you play, you know, touring, traveling teams and independent leagues, and you essentially play baseball all the time. And so if you're a pitcher, you're pitching all the time. And I am not done with this book yet, but I am reading this book. And it is really interesting about sports. It is really interesting about medicine. He gets Sandy Koufax to talk, and Sandy Koufax does not talk very often, but he gets to talk about his essentially loss of his arm, partly because this surgery hadn't been pioneered yet. It's a really, really interesting book, and it deals a lot with trying to protect this one joint that is the most valuable thing that you own. And can you protect it? Can you rehabilitate it? What's the percentage that you'll ever come back? It's a really fascinating book, and I am very, very much enjoying it. Again, it's called The Arm by Jeff Passan, Passan. I apologize again if that is mispronounced. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Katie at Love is Maroon. That's Love is a Maroon. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are buying tickets to our live show at nprpresents.org to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.